All right, continuing our exploration of eschatological optimism by Daria Dugina, we're going to look at the concept of hierarchy and hierarchy and holiness, hierarchy and integrality, right? So what is the relationship between hierarchy and the whole? What is the relationship between the parts of the hierarchy and the hierarchy as a whole? And I think it's really excellent exposition here by Daria Dugin of thinking through how hierarchy is operationalized in the physical world. And she sees it as a reflection of the hierarchy in the holy world, right? There's a kind of relationship and ratio there. And she talks about how hierarchy always presupposes a whole, and hierarchy breaks down when the whole is no longer unified. So I think that resonates a lot with kind of what's happening now. And she dives into the caste system of India, looking at hierarchy and the different relationships. She looks at the church hierarchy, cosmic cycles. So I'm just going to introduce here with the little reading here. Let me know what you guys think. I propose that we reflect on a model of sacred order and reproduction of this divine model in the world, in the church and the angelic ranks. Today we'll be talking about hierarchy, and in the course of our discussion we will touch on domains that are ultimately inseparable from one another: politics, economics, and religion. As a follower and scholar of Neoplatonism, I naturally adhere to the position that it is impossible to consider the religious separately from the political separately from the psychological, etc., because everything is tightly bound together. I wonder what you think of that. In terms of the intrinsic relationship between the political and the psychological, for example. We will try to approach the question of tripartite anthropology and hierarchical experience holistically from the standpoint of integrality. We will briefly dwell on the very notion of hierarchy, how it appears, develops, and is understood in Indo-European society, that is, in India and ancient Greece. Then we will move on to hierarchy in Neoplatonism, to how hierarchy is transformed in Christianity. We will touch on Dionysus the Areopagite. Then we'll move on to the Middle Ages, and finally to the era of modernity. Everything will be outlined in broad strokes, because in order to build an overall picture, it is necessary to go through several paradigms and historical eras. We will end with postmodernity, where hierarchy is completely abolished and disappears in favor of universal equality, anti-patriarchy, and the revolution of the fourth estate. In this historical philosophical survey, my own preferences are obviously on the side of tradition, but one should not be surprised at the mention of hypo-objects, hypo-objects, object-oriented ontology, or cyberfeminism. This is necessary because even if we have chosen the side of tradition and we intend to defend it in the modern world, we are obliged to be up to date with the current agenda and feel the pulse of modern civilization. Here we'll be forced to work with the depths of philosophical seeking as well as the superficial anti-hierarchical experience that has prevailed in modern society for the last several centuries. The faint light at the end of the tunnel of this lecture will be a small futurological projection of how hierarchy might possibly be restored in the modern world. My reflections are not concerned with specific political forms, but rather with philosophical concepts and paradigms that are as far removed as possible from ordinary practices and facts. In order to comprehend history, it is necessary to begin with paradigms and only then move to the particulars. This principle of moving from general to the particular will equip us with our main method of examination. Next section, defining hierarchy, sacred order, and the principle of integrality. And here's where she gets into this relationship, the idea of the relationship between the holy hierarchy and the holy and the sacred, and how those are related to one another. I found it compelling. So hierarchy is a notion that arose in Hellenistic Greece, or more precisely in the Roman Empire. It was developed in the heyday of the Eastern Christian theology during the time of Dionysus the Areopagite, approximately the 5th to 6th centuries AD. The term hierarchy comes from two words. The first is the Greek eros, sacred, from which is derived the word hierarch. The second is archi, that is the principle or authority. Among the ancient philosophers, the word archi, like arch, art, like archetype, archi, referred to the first principle of everything and designated a certain ontological point in the creation of the world. The very word hierarchy was introduced in the 5th century AD by the Greek author known as Dionysius the Areopagite, who was significantly influenced by Neoplatonism in his works on the celestial hierarchy and on the ecclesiastical hierarchy. It's important that the notion of hierarchy has always carried a holy and sacred character. It is a religious term. Even in the mid-20th century, Oxford Dictionary, the quote-unquote sacred, i.e. that which is connected with the religious side of life, with a systematization and establishment of order in the religious sphere, is acknowledged as central to understanding the notion of hierarchy. Today, the very same dictionary no longer treats hierarchy through the notion of the sacred, but instead explains it as a systematic organization of society, government, economy, class, and estate relations, and military subordination from the commander-in-chief to the ordinary soldier. In other words, the term hierarchy has had its nature changed in modern dictionaries. The sacred has been removed from the notion and has been desacralized, reduced to superficial secular exterior characteristics such as economic, class, sociological, etc. We tend to emphasize the traditional inner understanding of hierarchy and its sacred significance connected to religious cult and spiritual gradation in contrast to the exterior, purely external, superficial side of life. If you use the methodology of René Guénon, we must mention two hierarchies, esoteric hierarchy, that is, inner and sacred hierarchy, and exoteric hierarchy, which is associated with the secular side of everyday social existence. Under what conditions does hierarchy exist? Hierarchy exists when something is whole. Why is this so? If there is a whole, then the composition of this whole includes elements which can be arranged, ordered, and correlated in a certain way due to the fact that they belong to something singular and organic. I love that definition. Let me know what you guys think. If we do not adhere to holistic positions and instead proceed from the thesis of atomism, from the idea that the cosmos is originally fragmented, prioritizing the individual in society, then there can be no hierarchy, since according to this outlook, there is no whole within which the particular, the part, the atomic, and the individual could be in a structured, harmonious, and orderly relation with the other particular elements or the whole itself. In the absence of the whole, each individual represents only itself and has nothing to do with any whole. It is nothing more than an insignificant unit, an alienated atom, a separate fragment. Hierarchy, therefore, exists wherever there is a whole. Hierarchy may be defined in Louis Dumont's words, quote, as the principal way which the elements of a whole are ranked in relation to the whole. Now getting a little bit more into Louis Dumont here. One of the important thinkers who prompted and inspired me to deliver this lecture is the French social anthropologist Louis Dumont, D-U-M-O-N-T. I wonder if any of you are familiar with Louis Dumont or any of his writings, because I was not. The author of the remarkable book Homo Hierarchus. Dumont is an outstanding European Indologist, a scholar of hierarchies, castes, and other social structures who worked in his time with Roger Kallios, Marcel Mauss, and Georges Bataille. He had vast experience in studying the caste-based hierarchical society of India. Dumont is interesting because he was a social anthropologist with an accentuated traditionalist position, which is rare among thinkers in the 20th century and is at last almost completely absent in the 21st century. Dumont professed a well-defined, quote, macro narrative that stood for hierarchical society and critiqued modern society from the standpoints of the traditionalist worldview. In the West today, such quote-unquote grand narratives are no longer possible and are even unacceptable. An energetic fragmentation of consciousness is taking place in Western society, one that is deliberately, purposely, and aggressively practiced and supported both in the scientific community and on the level of ordinary laypeople. In our times, university lectures refrain from any serious generalizations and value judgments, and even more so from projects and setting goals. Louis Dumont engaged in impartially analyzing individualism in the era of modernity and the egalitarian theories built on such principles. According to Dumont, individualism is the antithesis of hierarchy, and it is on individualism that all modern theories of democracy, which Dumont saw as flawed, are based. Louis Dumont is the authority towards which we will orient ourselves. He is the central character of our lecture, the inspiration and mentor of today's survey, His works Homo Hierarchus and Homo Aequilis can be found in English, French, and even Russian. And so hierarchy exists whenever something is perceived as a whole. With any holistic model, whether we are talking about the entire cosmos as a whole, a community, collective, or society as fully fledged structures that operate as the measure of things. If the individual becomes the measure of all things, then, of course, no hierarchy arises. On the contrary, hierarchy is abolished both in theory and in practice. I wonder what you think of this as antithetical to kind of our Western notion of the importance of the individual. So I wonder what you think, if you can kind of square those positions, and is it necessarily, does individualism necessarily reject hierarchy? And back to the text. Dumont takes Indian society, which he meticulously and thoroughly studied, as a model and examines its intrinsic system of varna and jati, which are inaccurately generalized, defined in the Western terminology as castes. So we're looking at the Indian caste system here, as a classic example of a society structured on a hierarchical principle. From Dumont's point of view, quote, the castes teach us a fundamental social principle, hierarchy. We in our modern society have adopted the principle contrary to it, but it is not without value for understanding the nature, limits, and conditions of realization of the moral and political egalitarianism to which we are attached. Why, Dumont asks, should we travel to India if not to try to discover how and in what respects Indian society or civilization by its very particularity represents a form of the universal? He points out that modern anthropology does not do justice to the Indian theory of Varna, the caste, which it views as a mere relic. All right, so let's look at examine the Indian caste system. Here, I will also draw on Louis Dumont's works Homo Hierarchus and Homo Aequilis, set the task of retrospectively tracing the path traversed by our civilization from hierarchical society to the modern egalitarian one, as well as on the works of others, scholars of Indian society, first and foremost René Guénon, Julius Evola, and Marcia Ladd. India's caste system or system of hierarchy is represented by the theory of Varna, translated from Sanskrit Varna means color, i.e. certain quality. There are four Varnas. They are first mentioned in the Rig Veda. A myth is expounded therein about how the world and the human types, the estates or Varnas, were first created. In Indian mythology, the main element was the primordial being, Purusha, out of whose body the universe was created. The Varnas, or castes, or estates, were created out of him. Purusha is one being, the integrality, the whole, that gives rise to the hierarchy. Wherever there is holism, there is also hierarchy, and vice versa. Where hierarchy is present, there is necessarily holism, and this means that individualism is absent. One of the Rig Veda's hymns, the Purushaskuta, tells in detail of the dismemberment of the all man. The text says that the highest Varna of Brahmins, the priests, was created out of Purusha's mouth. The Varna of warriors, the Kshatriyas, from whom the rulers and the kings come, was created out of his chest, shoulders, and arms. The laborers, peasants, artisans, and merchants, the Vishnyas, were born out of his thighs. Vaishyas. From his feet appear the Shudras, the lower caste, called only to serve the higher ones. This is how the four Varnas, the four castes, the four estates arose. There's also a fifth category, the untouchables, the Shandalas or Dalits, who are outside of society as such and have no sacred archetype. One of the first versions of the origin of the Varnas is continued in one of the oldest records of Hinduism, the Laws of Manu, which describe the functions of each caste down to the details. The system of Varnas in Indian society was designed to ensure integrity and order. For example, the, quote, order of increasing statuses, from the service of the Shudras to the economic activity of the Vaishyas and further to the political rule of the Kshatriyas and the sacred doings of Brahmins. As one moves from lower to higher Varnas, the degree of religious purity of the Varna increases, the highest expression being the Brahmins. According to the logic of Hinduism, society in general, encompassing all of its varnas, is a single living being, not merely a mechanical agglomeration of separate individuals. Just as different organs in the human body fulfill different functions without infringing upon one another, so do the varnas form a holistic organism, a body in which one part harmoniously contemplates another. We also encounter holism in Plato's examination of the idea of justice. He insists that society itself and its division into estates is possible only when there is a common whole. Plato names the three virtues of the three estates and says that there's a fourth, and that holds the virtues together, and that is justice. So we're going to get into a little bit of the castes, each individual caste, and I think it's interesting to explore what the roles of each of these varnas, of each of these caste systems, and think of it in terms of the leading and the building of a civilization. These roles, according to Indian cosmology, are important, and they all play a part, whole relationship to the moving forward of civilization. So we're going to look at the Brahmins here, the people of pure light, who are top of the caste system. This makes me think of Plato's philosopher kings, right? So these people that have ultimate authority in the hierarchy, what are their qualities and what should their nature be in relationship to the lower castes? An interesting question to keep in the back of your mind here. So the highest and oldest varna that is closest possible to the absolute, capital A, and which originated from Purusha's mouth is the caste of Brahmin priests. They are the ones with the right to perform rituals and enjoy immunity. Murder, execution, beating, punishment, exile, persecution do not apply to them. Killing a Brahmin is equivalent to destroying the sacred itself. The duty, the dharma of the Brahmin is to teach and learn, to sacrifice and make offerings, to give and receive. So at the top of the hierarchy, we have to teach and learn, to sacrifice and make offerings, and to give and to receive. Brahmins are not on equal footing with the other varnas. They are a completely separate priestly caste that can interact with everyone except the untouchables, who no one can interact with. It's interesting, the untouchables are the lowest caste, right? And this idea that the Brahmins can't touch the untouchables makes me think of Christ's incarnation being higher than the highest and then coming down to the lowest and actually uniting the hierarchy as a whole by uniting the highest and the lowest. That just kind of came up. And Dugina talks about the hierarchy in Christianity and in other contexts here a little bit later. So this will be a couple of parts to this video. So Brahmins have a developed system of taboos, such as in regards to marriages, and they have a special dietary system with prohibition on consuming meat. As a general rule, they are vegetarians. Brahmins are obliged to strictly observe the principle of not causing harm to any living beings. Brahmins correspond to spiritual authority and are the highest instance of such authority. This authority is symbolized by the color white. The Brahmins are associated with pure light. And among the three cosmic principles, the gunas, their souls consist of the element of sattva, meaning pure light. This is the contemplative principle of the soul. The aim of the Brahmin's life is knowledge, jhana, and upholding the sacred law, dharma. So Brahmins, priestly class, kshatriyas, or warriors of fire. We're going to explore their caste here. The kshatriyas are the second varna. This caste consists of warriors and influential princely and royal families. This varna is associated with action and Raja's guna and the color red. The Kshatriyan spirit corresponds to the chest, shoulders, arms of Purusha, as well as to the heart, since this area is associated with fire in Indo-European myths. The heart is the source of heat, and among the Greeks, it was the seat of the inspirited element Thymos. According to the Vedas, as well as ancient Greek pre-Socratic medicinal notions, fire is to be found in this area. Purusha spews fire and thus unleashes Rajas, the color red, and the caste of Kshatriyas into the world. Between the Brahmins and the Kshatriyas, as Dumont writes, there is a complex relationship of two forces, status and power or authority. Here we are dealing with an absolute difference between the rank of the priest and royal authority. Status, authority, and sacrality are inalienable qualities of the priest. Although the priest does not have power like the warrior and king, the latter are obliged to honor with his authority and recognize his spiritual dominion. The warrior in and of himself is not sacred. He needs sacralization, initiation, dedication. Genuine, legitimate power and authority in a hierarchical system is always sacralized by the priesthood. At the same time, however, the ritual supremacy and purity of the priest should not detract from or diminish the dignity of the king or warrior. It should not cancel out the significance of the functions that they perform. Royal power is seen here as an instrument of meditation, of mediation between the divine world of Dharma and the realities of this earthly world. Warriors are subordinate to priests in spirit, but in worldly affairs, the priesthood is subordinate to secular authority. I think this last part is important. I think it's something about reality and the relationship between those that hold power and authority versus those that interact, that operationalize such power and authority, or the priests and the warriors here. The important distinction, I think, has been lost. He says, warriors are subordinate to the priests in spirit, but in worldly affairs, the priesthood is subordinate to secular authority. I mean, we have no priestly class at all in the West, right? Which, you know, has its consequences. So Kshatriyas, like Brahmins, belong to the category of twice born, i.e. those within whom the heavenly and the earthly natures are combined. Therefore, they are not only immersed in earthly life, but also obliged to master the sacred texts, to go through training, to receive initiation, to participate in sacrifices, and to bring gifts offerings to Brahmins. The ritual aim of Kshatriya's life is love, karma. So the ritual aim of, remember, the priestly class, right, is upholding the sacred law, and to make sacrifice offerings and to give and to receive. All right, next is the Vaishyas and Shudras, submersion in materiality. The third varna of Vaishyas comes from Purusha's thighs and consists of pastoralists, farmers, merchants, and artisans. They are also considered to be sacred, but this time the earthly element is predominant. Their souls, according to Hinduism, are a mixture of fire, the rajas, and material darkness, tamas, which pulls them down. The lot of the Vaishya is the organization and order of earthly life. At the same time, they are also fully fledged participants in the hierarchy of Varnas, and they have their own rites and symbols, their own traditions and rules. Vaishyas are subordinate to the authority of the Kshatriyas and accept the authority of the Brahmins. A Vaishya's life purpose is artha, that well-being, prosperity, success, and wealth. Indian society, its hierarchical axis, is built out of the harmonious combination of these three varnas. We mentioned that the souls of the fourth estate, the Shudras, servants, hired workers, whose purpose is to obey and serve without envy, came from Purusha's feet. They too have their place in the hierarchy, but without any specific archetypal function, form, or vocation. It is important to note, however, that in the earliest stages of Indian society, there were only three higher varnas. The Shudras, and below them, the pariahs, the chandalas, created out of the dust under Purusha's feet, are mentioned only in rather late hymns in the Rig Veda. It is likely that the Shudras and non-caste chandalas were the natives of Hindustan, which were not integrated into early Vedic Indian society. All right, let's get into the untouchables next, so the chandalas. In India, there is yet another, a fifth category of the population, the untouchables, the outsiders. And I think what kind of came to me as I was reading this is, this hierarchy it orients towards dealing with the outside and dealing with those that are at the lowest part of the hierarchy. So when we're dealing with something like a border crisis or how to deal with immigration, let's see if we can get any insight from how in the ancient Indian caste system this was addressed, by how the untouchables were addressed and what was their role and function. So kind of keep that in the back of your head. So the untouchables, this is another story altogether. They have generally been struck out of the caste system of Indian society. We will only mention that the category of untouchables arose in deep antiquity and most likely refers to the local tribes who inhabited Hindustan before the arrival of the Vedic Aryans. In the early religious texts, however, they are practically not mentioned, while in the later laws of Manu, there are regulations on how they should behave. For instance, they are prescribed to handle affairs like collecting garbage and working with leather and clay. They lived in separate quarters, separate settlements on roadsides, and generally did not have the possibility of interacting with pure castes. The theme of pure and impure in hierarchy and in tripartite anthropology is one of the main features of the predominance of the sacred in Hindu society. Everything below the third caste, the Shudras and untouchables, is impure, which is to say, not touched by divine presence. The first three castes are twice born, while the rest are not. The notions of purity and impurity in Hinduism are associated with passing through initiation. If a person went through a rite of Upanayana, or second birth, the initiatic experience of discovering the universe when they became pure or even twice pure. When they were on a lower level, they were dirty and could defile others. The untouchables lived in harsh conditions until altogether recent times, their lives consisting of numerous restrictions and prohibitions. They were denied access to temples, shrines, and some public places. The system lasted in India for quite a long time. Now, according to some sociologists' estimates, untouchables and Dalits make about 18-19% of India's population. They are divided into various categories: tanners, washers, janitors, garbage collectors, sewage cleaners, masons, potters, slaughterhouse workers, basket and mat weavers, etc. The caste and estate structure of Indian society is also reflected in the Indian philosophy of Samkhya. According to Samkhya, the world consists of three types of matter, three gunas. These three principles correspond to the castes. The subtlest and most luminous matter, sattva guna, is associated with the intellectual and contemplative function. This is the domain of the Brahmins. It is symbolized by the color white. Raja guna is associated with fire, development, expansion, action, administrative function, the rational mind, and the movement of the soul. Its bearers are the Kshatriyas, the second caste. Its symbols is the color red. The mixture of the Raja gunas and the third guna, tamas, is characteristic of the Vaishya caste. Here, red is mixed with black. Finally, the third guna is tamas, whose name is translated as indifference and means darkness, death, ignorance, laziness in the realm of crude matter. This guna is predominant in the lower castes of the Shudras and the Chandalas. If Purusha is the spiritual principle of the world, and this being is sacrificed at the beginning of creation, dismembered and taken into to constitute the basis of the forms of the universe, then Prakriti is the material aspect of manifestation. It is also made up of three gunas. The Varnas are distinguished by their spiritual and material nature, i.e. by their relation to Purusha and Prakriti. The higher the Varna, the higher the caste, the more spiritual it is and the more subtle its representatives matter. Thus, Hinduism exhibits a strict picture of caste societal structure associated with the soul, the principles and qualities of the soul, and the elements of the body of primordial man, or first being, Purusha, who was dismembered. The theme of dismemberment of a god or a sacred hero is encountered in many religions. This is the classic scenario of dismembering and sacrificing the divine. In Hinduism, this is the manifest in the form of the division into castes. And I'll leave it with this section on cosmic cycles here. In Hinduism, the Varnas are bound to cosmic cycles, Manvantaras. These are periods of time, epochs. There are several such yugas or gigantic cosmological eras. There is the Satya Yuga, the Treta Yuga, the Dvapara Yuga, and the Kali Yuga. The Satya Yuga is the Golden Age. The Treta Yuga is the Silver Age, and then comes the Bronze Age, the Dvapara Yuga. Finally, there is the Kali Yuga, the Iron Age, the period in which, according to the Hindus, we live today. This is the period of the world's decline, the era before the end of the world. In Hinduism, however, this end is followed by a new beginning. Therefore, Indians prefer to speak of the end of a cycle, not the end of a world. This change of epochs or eras is characterized by the transition from one principle to another. When the intellectual contemplative priestly principle is dominant, we are in the Golden Age. When there is a transition to the phase of the Raja Gunas, where the fury of warriors dominates, this is the era of the Treta Yuga. When we move into the darker era corresponding to the Vaishya caste and a combination of Rajas and Tamas, that is, military fury and crude materialism, this signals the arrival of the Dvapara Yuga. The most terrible time, the Black Era, is the Kali Yuga, where the material civilization of the consumer society is dominant, that which we face today, not only in the West, but unfortunately in Russia as well. In each of the successive yugas within the greater Manvantara cycle, morality and intellect fall, and ignorance and vice versa. The end of the Kali Yuga is supposed to be marked by the appearance of a savior and restorer of the golden age on a white horse, Kalki, the 10th avatar of the deity, Vishnu. He will purify the world and initiate a new Manvantara. This is the end of the beginning again. This is the end in the beginning again, as Lev Gumilev titled on one of his books. Scholars of India and traditionalists who have written about the different orders of hierarchies associate the process of fully fledged hierarchy's perversion with a revolution of warriors. The Kshatriyas rebel against the Brahmins, the warriors' revolution overthrowing the priesthood. The Brahmins then cease to be the highest spiritual authority. Henceforth, warriors rule by direct strength and might. Hierarchy has already been broken, as the secondary has been put in place of the primary, and thus the entire social order begins to undergo increasing entropy. Then comes the next downward shift, the revolution of Vaishyas. The Vaishyas' usurpation of power is a total overturn of the hierarchy. The economic, artisanal, lower element begins to rule over the higher and the spiritual. Priests and warriors begin to be subordinated to economic factors and become dependent on the material side of things. Power is seized by financiers, entrepreneurs, and managers. Next comes complete disintegration, falling into the state of tamas, where there are no castes at all and there is no place in society left for the fully fledged human being. Man himself is now lost and fragmented. This is the end of the cycle. The human being is denied qualitative differentiation. Hierarchy collapses completely. Here appears the mythical idea of equality, that is, in actual fact, a direct expression of dark, infernal matter. Such an end of the cycle embodied in the collapse of hierarchy and wholeness is described in the classical Indian texts. This model of the historical process is also adopted by the traditionalist philosophers. Thus comes the final stage, the final age, the Kali Yuga, the era of democracy and equality, the worst forms of social political organization. The term democracy is, of course, not used in Hinduism, but in Rene Gonon we encounter the thesis that the Kali Yuga is marked by the transition from hierarchy to democracy, which promptly turns into plutocracy. Gonon says that the modern West has arrived at its decline precisely because it was the first to go through all the stages of the decline of the caste. Forgetting the sacred nature of hierarchy, modern Westerners have forgotten their inner spiritual dimension while focusing entirely on the exterior. Hence, hierarchy collapsed, and the West lost the sacred, divine principle manifest in this hierarchy. All right, I'm going to end it there. Next section, we're going to go into Plato's sacred time, and we're going to get into hierarchy and Christianity. So let me know what you guys think, and until next time, God bless.